Truly understanding your identity is a deeply personal story, and discovering who you are starts with knowing where you came from. This principle applies to us as individuals as well as collectively. Though it's popular to question the existence of a historic Adam and Eve, did they truly exist? Were they merely archetypes? The truth is, much of our uniqueness as humans only makes sense in the light of the Genesis account of creation. These questions and more are explored at length in a free download I believe you'll enjoy called Don't Dismiss Adam, Eve and the Genesis Story. It's more relevant today than ever. Discover even more about who you are when you go to premierinsight.org/resources and download this important resource. That's premierinsight.org/resources. I encourage you to do it today.
When you're juggling everyday life, carrying your faith isn't always easy. Introducing Journa, Premier's new devotional journaling app, created in partnership with World Vision. Each day, Journa gives you a Bible verse, a short reflection, a question to sit with, a written prayer, and space for your thoughts, all in one place, wherever you go. Find Journa in your App Store today, available on iOS and Android. Journa, an app to help you stay connected.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim. It's good to be here.
And this is resuming, I suppose, our long-running series over the last few months on the kind of broad, grand narrative of Scripture, the deep story of the Bible, as it's sometimes called. We started with back in the last year with a chapter on creation. We then moved on to the fall. We then did redemption, and we're now kind of completing the story with what we're calling new creation.
Yeah. It's us trying to pretend to be theologians, Tim, which I know is
dangerous, we're not ground.
Terribly good at it, but nonetheless, hey, there's a wonderful. I'm just reminded of a bit where C.S. Lewis, who of course was not a professional theologian, and never did any theological training, and he's got a wonderful essay where he sort of says, you know, I'm daring to comment on what some of the shepherds believe, And he says, of course, I'm not a shepherd. I'm just a sheep. But even the sheep are allowed to have the occasional bleat. And he then proceeds to give this devastating critique of liberal theology, and particularly biblical criticism. You know, so it's a kind of sort of faux humility. But we're just
tradition,
sheep.
Yeah, just sheep having a little bleat. But as we said in previous episodes, the reason we're talking about this is because it is highly relevant to what we talk about on regular episodes, you know, that we don't want to just, you know, when we're struck with an unexpected technological or scientific development, to just try and, you know, grasp at ideas out of the air when we're trying to think about how Christians should respond to this. We actually want to have a foundation, a framework, and an ethical lens through which to view these things that is grounded in the deep story of Scripture, in 2,000 years of Christian tradition, of much wiser, godlier people than us who've gone before, so that we have some basis for kind of building our maybe slightly more kind of speculative ethics on top of that. So that's why we're spending time on it, and that's why we want to share it with the listeners, is because actually this helps us make sense of all the other stuff we talk about.
Yeah, for me certainly, I first came across this framework as a fairly young Christian in my 20s, and I've always, ever since, I've found it a helpful framework, as one that I've constantly gone back to. And although it's at one level it's very simple, it's actually very profound. And in particular, I think what I've grown to appreciate is that fundamentally this is about a narrative. It's about the great narrative of the Bible. And it's been said that we have to indwell the story of the Bible as the true story of the whole world. In other words, when we read the story of the Bible, it's not just one narrative amongst many. It's claiming to be the narrative of the cosmos.
And a meta narrative.
It's a meta. Yes, all right. And what's more, it's claiming that we are actually part of the narrative. We're not an observer reading this novel and saying, gosh, that's an interesting story. No, this is our story as well. Mm. And the thing that really excites and interests me, especially about this last episode of The Four, you know, we're looking into the future, is that it's a common trope, isn't it, that if you read a spy novel, a whodunit, Agatha Christie, you name it, it's often that the meaning of the entire narrative is only revealed in the final pages. It's as you read those final pages and the denouement that you say, oh, that's the reason that that happened. Oh, and now I understand. That was why she said that. That's what was going on there. And so it's fascinating, isn't it, that a narrative can go forward in time, but you actually only understand it as it gets to the end. And so in the same way, it seems that's also true of the grand narrative of the cosmos. We can only understand the meaning of what's going on now if we read the final pages.
And when you read the Bible backwards in that sense, through the lens of what it tells us is coming, you can then go back through the whole New Testament and the Old Testament back to creation. And as you say, elements start to fall into place and to make more sense. And you say, okay, that's why this happens. That's why God said that. That's why. And you almost have to get to the end of the story to be able to make sense of the very beginning.
That's right. And so if you just take those four, creation, fall, redemption, and then this final one has different terms. The original term that I learned was consummation, which of course has all kinds of implications, not least that you talk about the consummation of a marriage and so on. It has kind of sexual connotations. And yet I think it's partly an appropriate term, but I think also to think about creation, fall, redemption, new creation is also a helpful way of looking at it. But if you think of those four, you could see that there's an inner story of fall and redemption, two and three, but that, and which is often the way that the Christian story is often presented in evangelical teaching and preaching, that it's basically a story of fall and redemption. But that fall and redemption narrative is nested within a greater narrative of creation to new creation. And I think it's just interesting, and to be honest, rather sad, that in contemporary Christianity, as we experience it here in the UK, it seems as though the story stops at redemption. It's almost like as though people are reading an Agatha Christie and everyone stops before the final chapter. Because what's the point, you know, before Hercule Poirot has gathered everyone in the drawing room? You know?
It was so, the butler. It's always the butler.
Was it the butler? So why is it? Why do you think our contemporary evangelicalism has a lot to say about 1, 2, and 3, and seems to markedly underplay 4?
It's a good question. It's certainly, I think, undeniable that a lot of the kind of church traditions that we're familiar with seem to be laser focused on fall, you know, on sin and cross, you know, from the apple to Calvary rather than from the garden to the New Jerusalem, to use that kind of language. I think there's a part of it which is that it seems, talking about heaven seems kind of cheesy and trite. It's all very kind of remote, doesn't feel directly relevant to how we live our lives now. I know a lot of churches focus a lot of their teaching about, you know, it's about evangelism. So if you're not yet a Christian, believe. And if you do already believe, it's about discipleship. It's about how do you live in the light of that belief in the here and now? How are we supposed to be ordering our lives? How are we supposed to be, you know, contributing to the life of the church, sharing our faith, you know, all that stuff? And then I think to sit back and say, and here's what's going to happen after you die and Jesus returns, feels
quite airy-fairy. It feels distant and, something that's not massively directly relevant to what we're doing in the here and now.
Yeah, I think there's a lot in that. But if you were to take a sort of long-term historical perspective of the church over, you know, 1,000, 2,000 years, I think you could argue that this contemporary sort of 1960s onward evangelicalism is surprisingly this world orientated. It's surprisingly materialistic. It's surprisingly focused on the here and now. And if you were to look back at many other forms of Christian worship, Christian teaching, Christian expressions over the last 2,000 years, many, many of them were much more orientated towards looking towards the future, towards the spiritual realities. So why is it in the bigger historical context that we've become so this world focused? Is it actually that we are absorbing the materialism of our culture?
I mean, that's the obvious answer, isn't it? That, you know, we live in an era of late capitalism, as it's sometimes called. You know, we've reached this kind of apotheosis of consumerism and materialism and kind of satiation. Christianity is an intensely, unfortunately, kind of middle class preoccupation on the whole in the Western world, where people live comfortable lives. And so I think a part of the story is that we have become focused on the here and now because that reflects the kind of preoccupations of our wider culture, which doesn't, which is not apocalyptic, which is not obsessed with kind of striving for progress. It's about how do we live good lives right now? And we don't really think too much about the past or too much about the future. I mean, the other thing I would say actually is that the only kind of elements of Christian tradition, evangelical tradition, which do focus on eschatology, as it's known, the eschaton, the second coming, the what's all that, it becomes very, very kooky. You know, this is basically coming out of the United States. But, you know, when I was growing up, the only people who were really talking about heaven and the second coming were talking about the Rapture or the Left Behind series of novels. I didn't even come across those, and deeply complicated theological arguments about, are you a premillennialist, a postmillennialist, or an amillennialist? You know, when is the thousand-year reign of Christ going to come? Is it going to come after the second coming, before the second coming? Will all the non-Christians disappear? Will they be converted? Where does Israel play into this, you know, dispensationalism? And it, you know, as a non-theologically trained person, I got the impression and was kind of steered this way by the people kind of teaching the Bible to me as a teenager that this is very silly. This is very untheological. This is a poor use of scripture. It's speculative. It's unhelpful. It's unwise. Just don't go near it. It's super kooky. And so, but there was nothing to replace it. It was just like, if you talk about the end times, you know, that's the language of, you talk about end times, that is a road to kind of like falling out of robust evangelical orthodoxy. So just don't go near it.
Interesting. Yeah. I think there's a lot in that. I also wonder whether when it comes to the public face of the Christian faith, how do we present Christianity to those who don't believe in it and to our secular world? I wonder whether that Marxist criticism that Christianity was an opiate of the people, that what it did was that it dulled their pain and their sensibilities because it gave them this false hope of a future rapture, a future paradise. And in Marxist terms, that's all false consciousness. That's a way of preventing the masses from rising. You know, you give them all this anodyne stuff about future resolution of all their suffering. Maybe when it comes to apologetics and to presenting a face to the world, Christian apologists were so sensitive to that jibe that they downplayed any kind of arguments about the future.
Yeah, I can certainly believe that. I think probably mostly subconsciously, but there is certainly, I think Christians often feel sensitive about the idea that it's kind of wish fulfillment.
it's trite, it's naive, and if you want to show Christianity to be a kind of intellectually robust body of ideas, that, you know, you don't want to fall into the trap of being kind of easily dismissed by this kind of post-Enlightenment kind of arch cynical, oh well, of course you would say that, that's just wish fulfillment, and so maybe we don't talk about it because we do secretly kind of worry, as you say, that that kind of jibe has teeth, and that it's, you know, it's all about the cross and about sin and atonement, and we don't really think very much about, you know, the rest of the story.
And certainly I can remember as a young Christian, you know, I really got the idea of the cross and how Jesus' death was something of momentous significance and how it had huge implications for the way I lived and so on. But I was often puzzled about the resurrection and why some people said it was so important, because why did it matter so much? I mean, provided Jesus has died for our sins, then okay, we're going to die, but we know that because of his death, we've been set free. So why this big deal about the resurrection?
Do you know what? I actually had exactly the same, you know, 40 years later, exactly the same kind of internal thoughts as I was a teenager, because I think exactly the same way the evangelicalism I grew up in was hyper laser focused on the cross and atonement and of substitution and of, you know, an almost kind of mathematical formulaic approach. You know, there was a debt in the ledger, my sin, and then that debt had to be wiped out, and it was wiped out by Jesus' death, and that kind of brings me back into right standing with God. I'm no longer in debt. The problem has been solved. And then the question is, well, then why does the story not end there? Why do the Gospels make so much of the resurrection when actually Jesus has already won by dying? And it's great, it's fun that he gets resurrected. That's kind of cool. But like, how is this essential? How is this necessary because if it's all about obliterating the penalty for sin, that's already been achieved by his death. And so I think unintentionally, no one wanted to tell me this, but you kind of presume that, well, therefore resurrection is kind of secondary. It's kind of a nice addition. It's a fun kind of twist at the end of the story. But it's not fundamental to what Jesus came to do. Like, the job he came to do was die, not die and rise again.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Whereas now, almost 50 years later, I have to say my perspective is completely different. And although, yes, the cross still has that central place, it is the cross fused with the resurrection. The cross without the resurrection would be simply meaningless, in my thinking now. So it is interesting how these things change. And in particular, as you get older, you know, it is easy to lapse into a kind of pessimism, fatalism, even despair. Particularly, you know, the world today and the news we're hearing and so on, despair is not something confined to the oldies, is it? I mean, there's a whole lot of despair in the younger generations as well. But I think for me as an old person, coming back time and time to the realities of the resurrection and all that it represents is an absolutely central part of my Christian faith.
Hmm. And what the kind of orthodox teaching of the church, which I hadn't had very well explained to me as a teenager and only grasped later, is that actually the death and resurrection are an inseparable kind of single event. You know, it's exactly. Not that Jesus died and he'd done the job and then God as a Billy Bonus threw in him a resurrection. It's that if he hadn't been raised, the whole thing is pointless. The whole rescue mission has failed. Because if we are united with Christ, then if he isn't raised, then we won't be raised, irrespective of what happened, of him taking our sin on the cross.
Yeah. In fact, Christianity just becomes a version of Platonism, which says that in the end, it's the immortal soul that's the important bit. And Jesus' immortal soul has gone back to his Father. And, you know, and our immortal souls have been rescued. And that
we can
is
leave behind this veil of tears that is the physical world and ascend onto a cloud, strumming a harp in kind of disembodied bliss.
But of course, what that message is that death is one. Death is natural. Death is part of the way that disembodied souls are released from their prisons. And death is therefore good. Death is the part of the release. I mean, this is Platonism. This is also Gnosticism, which the early church very early on was confronted with.
I mean, it even has similarities with completely other Eastern traditions, you know, Hindu traditions about reincarnation, or in Buddhism, where the goal is to break the cycle of death by becoming disembodied, by separating yourself from this, you know, endless birth, death, birth, death. But the whole point is you want to leave behind, death is unavoidable. And so the whole point is not to defeat it, but is to supersede it by becoming disembodied.
That's right. And of course, this is why the early apostolic teaching about the resurrection of Christ was treated with such contempt by the professional philosophers and thinkers. And you get that, don't you, in that wonderful description of Paul and the Areopagus, you know, where the elite come to discuss their advanced philosophical theories, and here comes a babbler who's talking about people being physically resurrected. My dear, how crude is that? What is this babbler? He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities. I mean, we've moved on from that. That's really sort of low grade stuff for the peasants. And yet that was the whole point, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And the point I remember reading years ago, that is that Christian resurrection is not just kind of like shocking and crass and antithetical to kind of refined classical philosophy from the Greek world, but it was also shocking to the Pharisaical Jewish tradition that Paul came from, that Jesus was encountering in the Gospels. You know, they didn't believe that individual people could be raised from the dead, or that God had any interest in that. So what Jesus is teaching and what the disciples are witnessing to is outrageous to both contexts, the Jewish one and the Greek kind of secular one.
Exactly. And it was completely unexpected for everybody. Nobody but nobody thought this was going to happen. Of course, you know, you go back and you can see these hints in the Old Testament, and if they'd only read it carefully and they could have said what Isaiah had said. And
well, this is the whole road to Emmaus, isn't it? You know, where the resurrected Jesus appears and the two disciples, one don't recognize him, which we'll talk about in a minute. Yeah. But also, you know, he has to spend, you know, 2 hours. It's a 2-hour walk to Emmaus, 2 hours talking them through and pointing out all the bits of the scripture that they missed, where it showed that the Son of Man had to suffer and then rise from the dead.
Yeah. So it's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, completely and utterly unexpected. Nobody thought this was going to happen. And yet, boom, something happens. And those stories of that first Easter Sunday are extraordinary stories. They still, when you read them, they still have this air of utter incomprehension, amazement. It's almost like it's too wonderful to believe. I daren't believe this. I mean, this is Doubting Thomas, isn't it? Doubting Thomas says, it's just too wonderful.
It's too good to be true.
It's too good to be true. I don't want to be fooled again. I don't want the terrible disillusionment.
Yeah.
I daren't believe this. It's too good to be true.
And so I guess we need to really think about, what do we learn from the resurrected Jesus? That what does that tell us about our future hope, about the bigger picture? So we know this one man, the God man himself, is resurrected. But what can we draw from these stories? What does the Bible say about what that means for our kind of eschatological resurrection?
Yeah, and of course, part of the whole problem here is that we're now into speculation and controversy. And I think this is another reason, isn't it, why preachers so often want to steer clear of all this stuff. Because you can't get away from speculation. And yet there is definitely some remarkable things to to glean from this. And we'll put some books in the and other further reading in the study notes. For me, the book which I found absolutely remarkable, although also almost impenetrable, is a book called Resurrection and Moral Order by Oliver O'Donovan. And because in it he unpicks some of the broader implications of resurrection in a very profound and masterful way. But in essence, I think what the resurrection is, a confrontation with divine power, a completely unexpected new insight into the power of God. And instead of the power of God being revealed in a purely spiritual, non-material way, actually the power of God and God himself is being revealed in physical form, in a material form. But I would want to describe it as, it, in other words, it's physics, but it's physics 2.0. It's a different kind of physics. It's a more advanced kind of physics. But, you know, as I thought about it, reflected about it, there's one simple fact about the resurrection which I don't think receives enough attention. And that is that all the gospel writers are absolutely adamant that the grave is empty, that the molecules which compose Jesus' body, those physical bits of stuff, all the flesh and the bones and the bits of Jesus' body, they are not physically in the grave. And so the obvious question is, well, where are those molecules?
And that's why, you know, the initial thinking is, well, there's no body here, therefore someone's taken it away, the Romans, the Pharisees, the gardener. And then they never possibly close their mind that those molecules might still be walking around the earth, but walking rather than being dragged. And so when the, you know, Mary in the garden sees Jesus, she doesn't recognize him, thinks it's the gardener. The disciples on the road to Emmaus don't recognize him, you know.
Absolutely.
I've often pondered about that. Is that because he looked different, or is that because it was just simply so inconceivable, you know, in the way that if I knew someone had died and then saw them in the street, I would just presume that it will obviously can't be them, it must be someone else? Or were they kind of supernaturally kept from recognizing him to make a kind of point?
A very good question. And again, we're into speculation, aren't we? I mean, my hunch is that he did look different. Well, the fundamental thing we have time and time again in these resurrections is it's the same but different. There is continuity but discontinuity. So in some extraordinary way, Jesus' appearance was the same but different. And because it's very striking, isn't it? Mary, who has this very intimate relationship with Jesus, you know, who has no doubt stared into his face for hours, looks at the risen Jesus and doesn't recognize him and thinks he's the gardener. And it's not until he says those words, Mary, that instantly recognizable voice breaks in on her. So he's the same but different. And yet, you know, he's got the wounds in his in his hands.
And his side, yeah.
In his side. So there is absolute proof that it's the same, the same molecules. And also, not just physically, I think what's also so wonderful is that he's the same personality-wise. Mm. You know, so if you think of the scene of the barbecue on the beach, you know, I've often think, you know, if you were writing a science fiction story and you finally got to the crux point when the human, divine human, has reappeared, you know, in total power, has destroyed death. Now what you're going to write, and the last thing you're going to write, is this prosaic, homely little scene of a fire and some fish, and are you hungry? And which bit would you like? Yeah. And yet, it seems to me that's the whole point. before the resurrection, he loved to spend time just doing these simple things, providing food, talking, chatting. And lo and behold, after the resurrection, he's the same person. He's got the same personality. He's got the same interest in his disciples. He teases them. He guides them. He challenges them. Peter, do you love me? He's the same guy. And yet he's totally different.
And that's what I find so baffling and intriguing about the scars in particular, because as you say, it's the same body, it's still got the scars, yet it can kind of, you know, move, walk through walls and disappear and reappear in certain places without needing to travel. And there's kind of hints of them this being kind of some kind of different superpowered kind of human. And I think in many ways, often our understanding of resurrection and of the new creation is that, you know, it's like the world it is now, but everything is fixed. So everything that we have now, but it's made better and fixed. And so the presumption, I think, if, you know, if I was writing the Gospels, you know, the presumption would be, well, of course, Jesus's body is the same as it was before, but it's all fixed. You know, so his kind of, you know, his bad knee is fixed and, you know, that scar from when he hit his head as a child is gone because he's perfected. But it's not. He's still got a hole in his side where the spear went. And the implication in the scripture is that to this day, the resurrected, ascended Jesus at the right hand of the Father still has a body which bears scars, which is in some sense not perfect. How do we understand that?
Absolutely. And yet, you know, some of the old hymn writers, I think, isn't it, talks about the scars being glorified, that suffering and glory are two sides of the same coin. And therefore, actually, what is Jesus's glory? What contributes towards Jesus's glory in the new creation? And answer, it's the scars. You know, this amazing paradox. And is it possible that the same will apply to us? That the scars we bear that come from our service, our desire to follow Christ, the things that damaged us as we and all the rest, is it possible that they will also remain and be glorified? Again, who knows? This is all speculation, but I think there's a profound spiritual significance there behind the scars. The brokenness of Jesus is also his glory.
When you're juggling everyday life, carrying your faith isn't always easy. Introducing Journa, Premier's new devotional journaling app. Created in partnership with World Vision. Each day, Journa gives you a Bible verse, a short reflection, a question to sit with, a written prayer, and space for your thoughts. All in one place, wherever you go. Find Journa in your App Store today, available on iOS and Android. Journa, an app to help you stay connected. When you're juggling everyday life, carrying your faith isn't always easy. Introducing Journa, Premier's new devotional journaling app, created in partnership with World Vision. Each day, Journa gives you a Bible verse, a short reflection, a question to sit with, a written prayer, and space for your thoughts. All in one place, wherever you go. Find Journa in your App Store today, available on iOS and Android. Journa, an app to help you stay connected.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And what I love about it in particular is that it's not about like an etch-a-sketch. You know, those things where you do a drawing with all the magnets and then you just wipe the slider and it's just completely gone, like it was never there. And that Jesus's resurrection is not an etch-a-sketch. They haven't just shaken it up and wiped it out. It says actually everything, the 33 years of his life from birth till death on the cross, that mattered, that counted. It doesn't get discounted and discarded and wiped away and undone. And it's not just the scars, therefore, but it's also the memories he has of other good times, grilling fish on the beach and chatting with Mary and the other disciples. And, you know, I think it honors, even divinizes
the life he had before and says those 33 years that mattered, it's now been consummated, it's been perfected, it's been fulfilled, it's come to fruition, but it doesn't obliterate everything that came before. We're not starting from scratch. We are taking Jesus's kind of flawed pre-resurrection body and, as you say, turning it into Jesus 2.0, but it's not starting again. It's the Jesus that he was always supposed to be. And likewise, that means that our stories, all the way up to our deaths and our eventual resurrection into glory, does not, again, obliterate or discard everything that came before. The good and the bad are somehow bound up into our perfected, resurrected bodies.
Absolutely. And that's the way it was always meant to be. That was always part of the plan. And in fact, you know, some theologians have argued that, you know, if the fall hadn't happened, God's plan was always to go from 1 to 4. It was, in other words, he never intended to start again fresh. He always intended to incorporate the creation into his own being. So again, if you just reflect about the significance of the incarnation and resurrection, when Jesus is born of Mary, his body takes on human DNA. It takes on all the history of life on Earth. In fact, you know, from a biological evolutionary perspective, human DNA carries billions of years of life history on the planet. And when God takes on human form and his body is born within the body of Mary, he takes on that life. The whole history of life on Earth is incorporated into the divinity, into the divine being, which is now one person of two natures, as the Church Father said. And so that was always the plan. It was always God's plan to take the cosmos into his own being in some extraordinary way, but to do it through people. And then there's this beautiful idea, which I got originally from Paul Blackham. He said that it's as though God has made this cosmos, it's made it out of dust. And then he stoops down and he picks up a handful of dust and he pulls it into his very own being. And then when we die and are raised, the physical stuff of our bodies is pulled through into physics 2.0. And then after us comes the entire creation. So all the non-human animals, all the mountains and the galaxies and everything else is pulled through and transformed into physics 2.0. And that's why Paul says the whole creation is groaning and waiting for the redemption of humans. It's only going to be through the physical transformation of human beings that the physical cosmos can be ultimately transformed. I mean, that's the big picture.
The big part of the New Testament that people often go to think about the resurrection is 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul has a kind of extended bit of writing about, you know, what is sown dishonorable will be raised honorable, and talking about seeds and flowers and bodies and perishables. You know, obviously we're not going to do a full Bible study there, but what do you pull out of that matters in this story we're telling there? What can we draw from that particular passage?
Well, you know, being interested in biology, I think that seed analogy is extraordinary, because the extraordinary thing about a seed is it contains within itself all the DNA, all the information that is going to make up the future plant or human or whatever. And so there is a hidden continuity. I mean, if you look at a seed, I sometimes show a seed and say, well, can you see what it's going to be? Can you see what the plant's going to be? And you see this little brown bit. And actually, there are a few gardeners in the audience and they say, yeah, I know what it is. And the answer is it's a sunflower seed. And then the next picture has the sunflower. And then we say, well, the point is, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
The seed is in the process of becoming the sunflower. There is continuity and discontinuity. They are the same but different. And what Paul is saying is your body is like that. Locked inside your body is all the information which is going to make up this utterly different and inconceivable reality of the sunflower.
Yeah, which is, kind of something we're very used to, the idea that, you know, you plant an apple seed and one day it will grow into an apple tree. But actually, when you step back and look at the seed versus the tree, it's mind-blowing.
That
all the genetic information needed to grow into a tree that then produces more seeds is encoded in this tiny little brown pip, you know, this barely bigger than a grain of rice. And yet somehow everything needed to turn into a tree the size of a house is locked away inside there. And I guess it also tells us something about, for me, it tells us something about the futility of kind of precise speculation about our future hope. Because if you were able to talk to an apple seed and say, what do you think it's going to be like to be a tree? Yes,
exactly.
I think the seed has got no ability whatsoever to encapsulate or even the language to talk about that, because it's...
Well, we're going to be brown and strong and big and confident. Yeah. You know?
What would it feel like to be a tree compared to being a seed? You know, and not to say that we shouldn't think about what we're doing this whole podcast about the future, but also... potentially, I think, a note of caution about people who get so wrapped up in the precise mechanics of how the rapture will work and all that stuff is that actually these things are, to a degree, incomprehensible to us in our kind of fallen pre-consummated state.
Yeah, they're incomprehensible. But for me now, this incorporates such profoundly hopeful message. Because what it says is that what we do here and now is not a waste of time.
Mm.
You know, because at the end of that chapter, Paul has talked about all the wonderful transformation in 1 Corinthians 15. And he might well say, so therefore, guys, you really don't need to worry, because God is going to do this, you know, just... it doesn't matter what you do now, because you can be absolutely confident that God is going to raise you from the dead. In fact, he says, my beloved brothers and sisters, always abound in the work of the Lord, because you know in the Lord your labor is not in vain. So he ties the fact that what we do here and now is not a waste of time because of this reality. And for me, that constant reflection on that is really important to remind me about what I do today really matters.
Mm.
And that even when it seems that there is loss, you know, you pour out your love and your care on another human being, and then it seems like it's just wasted and the person dies. Your love and compassion is thrown in your face and you think, why did I bother? Mm-hmm. And yet what this Christian hope teaches us, you know, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, love never fails. There is something which we hang on to. And, you know, this image at the end of Revelation of the bride who appears in all her glory, and then it's in that it was given to her to wear her garments pure and clean and glorious, and so what are the garments in which the bride is clothed? And the answer is, for the wedding garments of the bride are the righteous deeds of the saints. In other words, all those innumerable tiny acts of faith and hope and commitment and sacrifice and discipline, all those tiny acts are not lost. They're not forgotten. They're part of the eternal, glorious garments of the bride.
Hmm. And people often go, don't they, to Revelation 21 when they're trying to think about heaven, the new creation, where we're going to live, and you have this remarkable passage about the new heaven and the new earth, and And the voice from the saying says, look, God's dwelling place is now among the people. He will dwell with them. He will wipe every tear from their eye. There'll be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. How do you think, in the light of that glorious hope that we've been kind of just sketching out briefly, that unbelievably kind of exciting future that we have in store for us, how does that change how we do ethics in the here and now? You know, how does this theology of the new creation and the resurrection, how should that impinge on our other episodes, how we talk about science, healthcare, technology?
Well, it's a hugely important question, and one which, you know, we continue to wrestle with, don't we? I mean, number one for me is we shouldn't be embarrassed about this story. We shouldn't downplay it. This story, even though many in the secular world will jibe and mock, secretly many are deeply envious that such an amazing story could be true. It's too good to be true. I don't think we should downplay it, and I think we have got to live every day in the light of it. And there's this amazing quote that comes from Ashley Cooper, the Earl of Shaftesbury, who spent his life in devoted to philanthropy, an immensely wealthy man who pioneered so much of social reformation. And he said toward the end of his life, "I do not think in the last 40 years I have lived one conscious hour that was not influenced by the thought of our Lord's return." And I just think that shows that for him, the reality of the future hope, far from it leading to a kind of quietism, did quite the reverse. It inspired him, much as in Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, it inspired him to abound in the work of the Lord, because he knew it wasn't in vain.
And that's the kind of fear, I think, isn't it, from some Christians, that if they get too excited or too into the new creation and the resurrection and our future hope, you fail to do the kind of work that we've been called to do in the here and now. And, you know, and we're not supposed to, Christians, to be kind of like giddy and we're supposed to be kind of sober-minded about doing the work of evangelism and discipleship and church planting and X, Y, and Z in the here and now, and not get distracted by what's coming next. Whereas you're seem to saying, actually, the people who are most captured by the truth of the end of the story are the ones who are able to live out this chapter of the story best.
Absolutely. And also there's a wonderful idea, you know, that in physics 2.0, time doesn't work in the same way. And so there's a sense that all this is already happening. The wedding feast of the Lamb is taking place. The melody of glory and celebration and worship is already happening. And if we've got ears to hear, we can hear the faint echo of this bleeding back into the present. A fragrance from the future can come. And I think, you know, from time to time, I just get glimpses of that melody. You can't get glimpses of a melody. Echoes of that melody, or a fragrance that I've never smelt, or something beautiful that I've never seen. I get glimpses of it. And the interesting thing is that fragrance can invade an intensive care unit. It can invade the deathbed and the place of suffering and loss and grief. So a beautiful phrase which I've pinched from somewhere else, I don't know where it comes from. Hope is to hear the melody of the future, and faith is to dance to that melody in the present.
I'm always struck by you wrote in one of your first books about this, and you had a quote from another paediatrician who you'd worked with alongside when you were working in the neonatal intensive care unit in the hospital.
And he said something along the lines of, oh, you know, it's much easier for you than it is for me, John. When I look after a dying baby, I'm sending them into the ground, into oblivion. When you're looking after a dying baby, you're sending them to heaven. You know, I'm sure he was saying that quite tongue in cheek. But do you think that's actually true, that because of your convictions, because of our convictions as Christians about what happens next, that can actually shape how we make choices in our lives in the future about how we, you know, in this instance, how you care for a dying child, but maybe in lots of other fields as well?
Absolutely, I think it's true. I think it really does change. And I've no doubt, you know, in medicine, you do see some doctors who have devoted themselves to fighting death out of a sort of existential horror of death. And everything they do is somehow to try to prevent death, to keep death at bay. And you sense that in many ways they're wrestling with their own demons about death in their extraordinary efforts to keep other patients alive. And doctors like that find it very difficult to ever stop, to ever say enough is enough, because that's to say that death is won. Whereas I think Christian physicians such as myself, and there are many others also, say that actually, yes, we do see that death is an enemy. Yes, we desperately want to fight against it. But actually, we don't see it as the final enemy. And therefore, there's a time when death can change from being this horrific, frightening reality into even a gateway, a strange kind of healing into a new and better reality.
Because we know that it is, ultimately has been defeated by Jesus, demonstrated by his resurrection. And I'm sure that's true in lots of other less directly fields, you know, knowing that the people that we're dealing with are, that their bodies are supposed to be kind of resurrected afresh, the same but different, should change all kinds of things about, you know, medical enhancements and transhumanism. And, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about it at some point, but you'll see in the news about Elon Musk implanting chips in people's brains and all of these things. Like, how we think about the ethics of that can only be done in the context of actually, what do we know about human bodies? Well, is that we know that they're on a trajectory to be towards being kind of glorified and raised up and pulled into the stuff of the Godhead itself.
Absolutely. But it's also, you know, historically and today, it continues to motivate Christian engagement with the nobodies, don't they? The outcasts, the, you know, the drug addicts, the people with hopeless psychiatric conditions, learning difficulties, the people, the very nobodies of society. This genuine sense of the the hope that is within us motivates and drives people to care sacrificially for the people who the rest of society disregards.
A final question then before we wrap up. I mentioned earlier about kind of my hesitation or anxieties around eschatology, because people get so obsessed with dispensationalism and millennialism and unpicking what that precise verse in Revelation means. We haven't talked about that. We talked a lot about the actual, you know, the resurrection of Jesus, our resurrection, but how the actual end times unfold. Does that hold any interest to you? Does that feature in this conversation, or is that just a completely separate kind of theological dead end sideline?
It's a really interesting question, and it's probably, it would almost do for another episode, because I think it's a big topic. I personally think it is really important to try to understand the signs of the times. I mean, Jesus said, you know, you can work out whether it's going to be sunny tomorrow or it's going to rain, but you can't read the sign of the times. And I really think, therefore, there is a role for at least some people to be really trying to understand what's going on in the current world and then relate it to what God's providential purposes are in history. And what strikes me is the way that I was taught these four signposts, these four foundations, was that between number three and number four, not a lot happened. You know, that basically Jesus rose from the dead, the Spirit came, and then our task was to follow Christ, to do his works in the world, to spread the good news about Jesus, and to wait for his coming when he was going to wind up the whole thing. And what nobody saw is what we're actually experiencing now. Well, virtually nobody saw this, which is a completely runaway explosive growth of science and technology, healthcare, agriculture, energy, you name it, which is utterly and totally transforming the world as we watch. And this seems to be on a runaway exponential growth curve. And the massive question for Christians is, what on earth does all this mean? What are God's purposes in this new surprising thing? You know, is this another surprising twist in the story which none of us saw? I mean, you know, one of the things which strike me is if you look in the what are the works of the kingdom which the prophet Isaiah foretold, it was that the blind would see and the hungry would be fed. And we are now seeing in the last 20, 30 years, after 2,000 years of Christian history, we are seeing the signs of the kingdom coming true across the world in a way that's never been seen before. Only the works of the kingdom seem to be happening not through primarily God's people, although God's people are strongly involved, but a lot of it is happening through secular atheists who are living out the most astonishing technological changes. And so what are God's purposes in all this? And what does this mean for the preaching and teaching of the gospel? These seem to, I don't have the answers to that, but they do seem to me to be incredibly important questions. And I'm just struck by how little people within the Christian bubble seem firstly to be aware of what's actually taking place across the globe, or secondly to be interested in it or think it possibly has any relationship to the great story of the cosmos.
Yeah, that's very interesting, and you can see very different responses to that fact. I mean, I'm just thinking about, you know, on the environmental angle, you have Christians who say, well, you know, because we know that God is you know, that God cares about this creation, is going to redeem it, and that we need to look after it. And then you have others who say, you know, well, because, you know, I'm thinking of the very controversial Pastor Mark Driscoll. I once saw a sermon he said where he basically said, you know what, I believe in Jesus, he's coming back to burn this all up. So yeah, I drive a 4x4, a gas guzzling truck, and I don't worry about my carbon emissions. You know, and so taking this in very different ways. So yeah.
Well, look, we need to come back and talk about this another time.
Clearly, I think we do.
This will be part two of the future hope.
All right, let's draw it to a close there. Then, thanks everyone for listening. I hope that was interesting. Please do get in touch as always. We're interested to hear your thoughts, your feedback, your comments. You can email molad@premier.org.uk. Don't forget always to check out Dad's website, johnwyatt.com, with lots of more interesting resources to read and listen to and watch. And we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
When you're juggling everyday life, carrying your faith isn't always easy. Introducing Journa, Premier's new devotional journaling app, created in partnership with World Vision. Each day, Journa gives you a Bible verse, a short reflection, a question to sit with, a written prayer, and space for your thoughts, all in one place, wherever you go. Find Journa in your App Store today, available on iOS and Android. Journa, an app to help you stay connected.